Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Saturn Vox podcast, where discussions of philosophy meet the liminal space we weave in dreams. This is your host and humble believer in posthumanism's place in both magic and art, Mikala Ann. This week, we are welcoming author, artist, and student of astrology, Arturo Martinini, to talk about Arturo's most recently published book through Revelor Press, titled The Oracle of Delph AI, an artistic rendition of the astrological image talismans representative of the seven traditional planets, the zodiacal signs, the decans, the fixed stars, and the lunar mansions. Co-created by Arturo with a little help from a non-human entity, that of AI. We discuss the ethical and ontological nature of using such a tool in talismanic creation, and Arturo's process in creating the book, and how other practitioners might find the book useful. This convo is an open dialogue on embarking wild new technological frontiers, as well as the ethics and ethos in the praxis of confronting the human and others' relationship to technological unknowns, as well as how these things interact with capital and our ability to access power in the world. I quite enjoyed this conversation with a dear friend and hope it opens up a dialogue of critical questions and theories on the intersection between magic, technology, and art for you. This podcast is brought in part by listeners like you. If you want to support the show and its humble host, hop on over to the Patreon at www.patreon.com/SaturnVox, where you can listen to extended episode content and join in on our community Discord server.
What's up? Really cool being here. Excited to, you know, see where this goes. So I'm here to talk about a book. I almost struggle calling it my book. It's definitely my book, but you know, we'll get into why that might not be the whole truth in a second. The book is called The Oracle of Delph AI, and it is a project that emerged from some personal exploration that I have done around traditional astrological magic, specifically in the field of talismanic imagery. It's imaginific rendition, basically. So what I did was, as I was studying these things, and I still am, just to be clear, I am not a officially, you know, practicing astrologer yet, or, you know, I haven't found my esoteric title, let's call it like that, for now. I am taking lessons from Christopher Warnock, which might be known to the esoteric and occult community at this point. And yeah, so in the course of learning traditional astrological magic, what I have started desiring for myself was something of a more comprehensive collection of pre-made imagery, basically to draw some inspiration for when having to make talismans for astrological magic purposes. And it turns out the tradition doesn't really have a whole lot from the past that's available to us, made exception for a few scribbles and low quality, you know, sketches, right? That you can find in, you know, this one version of the Picatrix, you know, that maybe survived, that has some cool miniatures on it, but we don't have like a codex, you know what I mean, of talismanic imagery that is collected by, let's call them like the main kind of categories, right? That you end up encountering when studying this particular science, namely the 7 traditional planets, the 28 mansions of the moon, the 36 decans of the zodiac, and also the 15 fixed Bohemian stars. So what I was going to do was take on this massive lifelong project at the time and told myself, well, look, someone is already doing this. And, you know, and so I was able to find a few modern examples of artists that, you know, like have built up quite a collection of talismanic imagery. But, you know, I wanted it to be mine and personal. And I also wanted to expand basically on what was already available, specifically in the decanic imagery. And so I was going to just do it by hand. But at the time, I found myself involved with artificial intelligence technology for a number of reasons. I was working on some media-related projects that were revolving around that kind of technology. And I was pleasantly surprised when I discovered that I could leverage this technology to help me speed up the process, and not only speed it up, but to make it very integrated in what the tradition itself called for, which is this kind of very time-constrained windows that the astrological magician has to create the talismanic imagery, namely astrological elections, right? So all of these talisman imagery, they also come with very specific instructions for when, you know, to create them.
Can you give us a little bit of a breakdown on why that is so, just in case somebody listening isn't aware of the difference between, let's say, like a folk astrological election in which they have a whole hour versus what you're talking about here?
Yes, totally. It's actually kind of what you just described, right? It's precisely that. And it's actually, yeah, so like a window to create a talismanic like image, let's call it at the peak of the election. For those who are not familiar with the term, it's something like what you're trying to do is you're trying to calculate the position of certain planets in certain signs of the zodiac at a certain time that is specific to where you are geographically as well. So, you know, you're looking at a number of, you know, traditional concepts that have to line up, right? Maybe sometimes it's a planet rising in a certain sign. Sometimes it's a planet, say, culminating, which is to say at the highest point in the sky. A planet has to be in a certain aspect to another, and so on. The moon has to be in the proper phase, and it has to be in a proper place, and so on. And so it's actually very specific and very hard to calculate and to find these times. And it averages about, you know, to about like anywhere from 20 minutes to sometimes like 45 minutes. And that's all you got. And so, you know, when making talismans, a lot of us moderns, right, when we try to engage, you know, with this tradition, we find it actually rather complicated to achieve that, because, you know, not many of us have access to, you know, or I should say a lot of us have lost a connection to these kind of more analog trades, right, such as, say, stamp making, or, you know, metal engraving, you know, printmaking, all of these things, you know, that would in fact be very helpful. The closest thing, basically, and this is something that even Christopher Warnock, which is a very strict, you know, Renaissance astrology practitioner, even he is embracing, you know, this problematic by saying, look, if what it takes for you to create the talisman is to print it out of a computer printer and then basically add some details to it, could be anything from coloring the image in to maybe drawing the planetary symbols yourself, whatever, you know, like whatever technique basically helps you get it done in time is supposedly justified, you know, because we don't have a way to go check if the old tradition, right, had some kind of kosher methodology that say, forbid, right, you know, certain ways of getting around the creation of the image. And so that's kind of precisely where the artificial intelligence as a tool struck me as something very, very interesting, you know, that was at the very least, worth experimenting with, right? And so I took the words of my teacher, right? You know, it's like, okay, well, if it's okay to use a printer, I suppose it is also okay to use a computer to help generate these elements and then do a lot of manual work to take these elements and bring them together into a cohesive image. And that's what the book is made of. So I actually love every time I get a chance to clarify this, because I am well aware that there is quite a controversial, kind of public dialogue around you know, the implications of using artificial intelligence, specifically in this case, the technology is called text to image, right? And so a lot of folks have been very concerned with this idea of intellectual property and, you know, ownership, right? And authorship, especially, right? You know, how do you think about a product that you are putting together and publishing and selling to other people that is ultimately made up of things that, according to one side of the dialogue, right, are not necessarily yours? What I would love to do with you today is kind of unpack this problem and hopefully give to as many of your listeners, you know, some tools to unpack this themselves and find the nuances and the interesting possibilities that exist within the realm of this particular technology. Because while it is true that one could basically simply say input something very convenient, such as, hey, make me a painting that looks just like those of X artist, right? And for obvious reasons, it is the more problematic, the more alive and contemporary the artist is, right? You know, that's kind of the big central, let's call it, you know, point of contention, right? And fair enough. Obviously, I feel like any act of creation should, you know, refrain itself as much as possible from copying, right? And try to enable other artists' works as a source of inspiration rather than a, say, blueprint that you simply carbon, you know, press on another medium and then just, say, pretend was yours, which is, I agree, not a particularly honorable way to go about making art. That said, what's very interesting about the path that I found in making this imagery is the following. So the process looks like this. What I do is I frame the generation of the images from a historical perspective, first of all. So I basically instruct the model as much as possible with my prompting. Prompting meaning literally just the text that goes into the little input bar that, you know, will generate the image. So I set the parameters to be generating imagery that it is medieval in nature. So I make sure that the images that the network will learn from, and this is also very important, what these networks do, they don't go and look at things and then try to copy them. What they do is they try to learn from them and then actually try to create something new that is based off of the things they learned. So even within the context of contemporary artists, there is kind of a strange gray area that is probably worth discussing at some point. That's not what we're going to try to do today because it's very, very complex. But this is just to say that it's not like if I say, hey, give me a painting, a medieval painting, right, of a frog, that it's going to come out, you know, the same as, you know, say, the frogs from Hieronymus Bosch or something like that, right? It's going to look at as many medieval frogs as possible and then just do a very innocent attempt, right, to do its best to please me, basically, right? And to, because that's literally how these things are kind of designed to be. I know it sounds weird, but it's kind of the best way to think about it, because it kind of takes the fear of, you know, like replacing people, I feel like, out of the picture. Like, these things are not smart the way we think they are, right? They have a very, very simple task. Now, it is true that the way that this task is like learning to happen is not clear. It's actually rather esoteric, right? It happens in a way that we don't fully understand once it's set in motion. But the principle is very basic. It's just trying to get as close as possible to this request as it can by learning from pre-existing images. So then what happens is so say that I am doing a Saturn talisman image and the traditional text is informing me about the shapes and concepts that go into this talisman. For example, one has a character that is described to have the head of a deer and the feet of a camel. And so it's this kind of, you know, strange zoomorphic, you know, human figure that's sitting on a dragon and then holding, you know, arrows in its hand. And there's, you know, other strange creatures, you know, flying above its head and below its head, depending on which tradition you're, you know, sourcing from. Some have like a crow in it. Some have other kind of animals. Anyway, point being, the model is not good enough to where you can just write out all of that and then it will just give you an image that looks like that. It struggles actually quite a bit to keep all of the elements consistent and certainly, you know, look like anything even remotely similar to mm-hmm. what you asked. And so what I ended up doing is basically collage technique. So what I would do is I would go in and say, go over maybe 20 to 50 versions of the one element, right? So like the deer head, right? I would like focus on a medieval painting of a deer head and then just try to inflect it with as much personal, you know, taste as possible. And then when I would find a piece that I would consider good, right, for that section of the painting, I would save that and then isolate it, right, in very similarly to, you know, like the way that you would cut out something from a magazine, again, to make a collage. So yeah, imagine you're doing collage, but the rule is you can only use medieval prints, you know, instead of like modern magazines, right? And so that's very much how I set up the workspace. Once I have all the elements individually cut out, then I use digital painting and my artistic sensitivity to piece them together and, you know, add the elements that, say, are not even possible to attain within the model, because those models, I want to remind, you know, anyone that you know, like, once interact with this, are very strictly censored most of the times. There are also ways to get around the censorship, but they don't provide as high of a quality in the image output. So it's actually very complicated to get some concepts. And as we know, the occult and esoteric tradition is rather full of very bizarre and uncomfortable, you know, type imagery that, you know, in a normal, say, environment will most definitely fall under the red flag, right? You know, like kind of blacklist of concepts such as sexual imagery, violence, gore of a certain kind, you know, illegal activities, whatever. You know, like there's like a whole thing that, you know, I mean, whatever, I get it. You know, like, this is like a service, it's a public service. So yeah.
Is there not a program of this type that allows you to upload an image and give it prompts for distortion? Like, because I get what you're saying, like, you can't have it search for, let's say, nudity. Like, it'll, and if you did use some sort of back wall to get that, it would be a downgraded image quality, which wouldn't then now match with the rest of your image quality, make a weird distortion in the whole collage. But if I could upload my own image and tell the program to distort it, does that not exist? I'm sorry, my ignorance on these program types.
Oh, not at all. Yes, the short answer is yes, you can do that, but you have to run your own model on your computer, which is now easier than it used to be, but it's still somewhat technically complicated. I wouldn't, you know, if someone asked me like, can anyone do this, I would say probably, but you'd have to follow a kind of step-by-step maybe video tutorial to get there. And once you do, yes, there are plenty of ways to and you don't even need to use it's called an initial image, right? Mm-hmm. Or a source image to achieve that, because once you can run a model that's not censored, then you can just prompt, you know, uncomfortable imagery, you know, just in that context. In the context of, say, Midjourney, right, which is a, you know, kind of like right now one of the two most popular options to interact with this stuff, if you were to try to do that on Midjourney, to use, say, a medieval painting that has nudity in it, there's actually an AI that is designed to look at imagery and then figure out if it's, you know, if it's like, if it contains that. And so it will flag you and tell you like, I'm sorry, I can't really do this with this image. So it's super annoying. It's like as gated as one would expect a product like that to be, which who knows, right? I mean, whatever. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's a good thing that there's like a super safe version of it, you know, for those who want to like explore it and feeling like there are those kind of guardrails around the medium. And then if you, you know, just like everything else, right? I mean, I feel like, you know, if you were on the internet in the 90s, everything was kind of like that to begin with. You know what I mean? It's like,
We all turned out fine. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no. But you know what I mean? Like there was always some kind of like kosher version of the internet, right? That like if you didn't want to know how to get around it, you know, like the stuff that came with your computer by the time we had like home computers, right? That were just like a product for consumers. Like you can just surf the internet and pretend, you know, there isn't such thing as, you know, a dangerous internet or something like that. So anyway, yeah, so that's what the process looks like on my end. And when I was done creating the full set, let's call it like the full set of imageries that I wanted to have for my own practice, right? You know, because again, like first of all, what I was really trying to do was doing these things and time them, right, with the say ingresses of the planets into certain signs, or I was trying to create the talismans again, like see if I could use this tool to accelerate the process of talisman making, but more than anything, to create something in a short period of time that I felt good about, right? Like aesthetically, like as an artist, you know, I mean, I'm sure you probably heard this or maybe experienced it yourself even, you know, like it's such a common experience of, you know, wanting to create a talisman and having this grandiose vision in your head of how it's going to turn out. And then it's like, you know, a little like squonky stick figure of a bird, maybe with like, you know, like a scribbly, you know, planet sign or whatever. And there's nothing wrong with that. But we definitely are in this strange resurgence of like, you know, public occult and esoteric personalities, right? You know, just like not having to hide that anymore. And so there is, you know, there is like something to be said for aesthetics right now in this particular time where, you know, like someone could be proud of, say, wearing a planetary talisman in public, right? And want that to be beautiful. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And so for me, at least, that really worked out quite well to create pieces that I would feel really good about having on my altar, say, for example, right? And that's what the project was. And then Reveler Press, it's actually really funny how we came in contact, because what happened is I got their book they put out a fantastic translation of an Arabic astrological magic text, as you know very well. and so, you know, in the book, there were these very beautifully drawn, you know, symbols for dimensions of the moon. And, you know, as a practitioner, I just got so excited that those were available. And So what I did, I integrated them into my drawings, and then I was, you know, I was like sharing those online. And so they reached out to me kind of in a panic, you know, with a cease and desist, basically, right? You know, they were like, what is going on here? You know, you didn't ask permission to use these things. And I, you know, admittedly, I didn't really like give it too much thought, you know, because I was doing it again in this kind of sort of personal, you know, spiritual way. And so in my head, I was, you know, in my head, it was something of a tribute, maybe. You know, I was like, I should definitely use these because they're so beautiful. It didn't occur to me that I was like using someone else's thing, you know. So, but then it was, it got resolved in a very friendly and rather constructive manner, and we were both really proud of how we handled it.
Well, everybody involved is a wonderful human being, so I'm not surprised it turned out that way.
Thank you for saying that. I agree. And so, yeah, a few months later, you know, I connected with Jen, which is the main editor and owner of Reveler Press. And we figured out how to turn this into a book. And so the missing piece at that point for the images was something of a context, right? Because granted, yes, a lot of people at this point in the community have heard of these concepts at least once. Not everyone is an expert or have, you know, dug deep in the tradition of, you know, astrological magic from the past, and specifically again the talismanic one. So we were kind of trying to figure out, how do we give context to these images, right? Like what do we do? Do we go look for the best scans of original manuscripts, maybe, and then so that people can see, right, how old this is, and then like have like a very modern image next to it. And where we landed was, well, what if we make the book something that is embracing this idea of there's no such thing as, you know, difference in time, right? Like, you know, what if we put ourselves in the mindset that time really is a continuum, and this tradition specifically is a particular kind of continuum, right? That you want to interact with according to, say, the principles of the anima mundi, right? Where things aren't progressing on some kind of straight line. They are kind of connected and moving, you know, with this beautiful cosmic logic, right? That entails everything and everyone from the top down and from the down up, if you know, if we want to put it in you know, in alchemical terms. And so what we landed was, okay, so what if we try to create pages that look like old medieval you know, like tomes of magic, but they are also made with artificial intelligence. And I feel like that's where the project really came together, is seeing those pages emerging from the system, you know, in relationship to each image, was where I got really convinced that this technology can 100%, if one wants, be integrated in one's spiritual practice as, you know, any tool that we use, you know, for, say, scrying or divination or anything like that. You know, it is, you know, I feel like you don't have to go that far to seek confirmation of this, even in pop culture, right? One of the most popular entertainment brands out there is called Black Mirror, literally, right? And it, you know, whatever, the whole thing poses this kind of, you know, like semi-philosophical questions about how to think of technology and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, here we are, right? You know, like some of us are, you know, using obsidian mirrors personally for, you know, for all kinds of magical purposes. And so I thought to myself, I have two options here, right? I can be afraid of this, and I can be judgmental of this technology's place in the tradition, or I can, you know, basically do the best I can to see if it can integrate into at least my experience, right? You know, like maybe I'm not going to try to convince other people at first, but see if it works for myself. And after doing this, I can say very confidently that while it is not something that I would think of as a replacement, right, for any of the other things, which still very much feel much more potent, say, and effective when it comes to spiritual practices, right? Like, you know, I mean, I wouldn't like try to digitize incense, right, or anything like that, you know, but
not yet.
That's right. Yeah, we'll see. VR.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah, once we get our electric noses, then it's all good. And so, yeah, I guess I would like to, like, before we get into, you know, like kind of more of a back and forth, right? You know, I would love to see what questions you have, you know, for me on this, but there's two things that I would like to say just to bookend my experience. One is, it's very interesting to me, having explored this, how my perception of the word technology has changed, right? You know, like trying to create kind of an internal cohesive narrative, right, for like how I think about these things. I found out quite a bit about the origin of the word, which I knew about before, but I never really maybe thought about it as seriously maybe or intensely as I had to figure this thing out once I had to interact with a public that was not, you know, necessarily interested in this or wanted to know more about it. So the origin of the word technology, right, you know, at least from the Greek language, is techne, right, which is literally like doing, you know, and acting upon things. And it is central to, you know, a lot of very complicated, you know, debates that are very, very old, you know, like this idea of theory and practice and, you know, like what is doing, what is art, you know, all of these things. Of which I will say, you know, right up front, I do not have the ontological tools to like talk about these things at a high resolution, but I understand. I never really thought of technology as something that was part of those more profound, you know, topics, right? And so that was very important for me to just shift perspective on how to think about technology. And so I'm still figuring it out, but I at the very least do not just, you know, kind of think about it casually as something that just means one thing, right? Oh, technology. Yeah, I know what that is. It's like machines or, you know, automatic stuff that is not of the world of everything that's not technological, right? Or whatever. It's such a label, I feel. And it certainly wouldn't have helped me to keep it in that box, right? To figure this stuff out. The second thing that was very important for me to kind of experience and realize having these thoughts was also, well, okay, so if this is true and technology isn't this, you know, kind of like one-dimensioned thing, then what is my place as a human in this, right? And why am I compelled to find solutions to perpetrate this tradition? Most recently, I've had an impulse to go and read and learn more about Mesopotamian mythology, and there's a lot of very, very interesting imagery in those myths, and one of them helped me develop a kind of personal worldview thing that I would like to share, which helped me a lot with, again, positioning myself in this picture, and that is this idea that humans are talismans of the gods, right? So to stop thinking about, you know, my place in this as some kind of, you know, spectrum, right? If there is like kind of a higher thing and a lower thing and human is somewhere in between, right? I actually like this idea that it's more specific, right? That the role of human, you know, is to do and to create, you know, in the fashion that the talismanic tradition describes, right? It's because what I love about talismans is that they are extremely purposeful. They are almost exclusively, purpose driven, right? You know, you make a talisman because you want to attain something, because you want to have control over something sometimes. Sometimes you want to invite certain things into your life, but purpose is very central to why you want to create one. And so I don't know, that's kind of like where I'm at with this, and that's what I hope the book can, you know, can offer, is this kind of like reflective space, right, as people, you know, might go through the images and use them for their own practice. Yeah, I just really hope that it opens up dialogue as opposed to, you know, like create more division and, you know, labeling around the issue. So
no, I love this. Wow. Okay, I have so much to say. It's going to be hard for me to reel everything back and contain every question with my ADHD brain, but I'm going to do my best. The first thing I wanted to bring up is like, well, it's no surprise to me that you and I actually met in person with a mutual friend, Joshua Madara, who was also the very first person I ever had on SaturnVox, because like I also kind of believe in this ethos of like robots as wildness, robots as like you were talking about them, and they're like that the AI program is almost like in its infantilized stage. We view them as these like weird overlords, but they're really like something quite different than that. I thought that that was a very salient thing to bring up. But the main thing I wanted to bring up about like my stance on this issue, and I don't think you knew my stance on this issue, and so I love that you decided to just like throw it out at me and be like, this is what I want to talk about. But to me, when I took philosophy of science, I wish I could remember the name of the philosopher who this comes from. My apologies to his ghost, but the idea of science as an instrument was the perspective that I ended up clinging to. And what that means, the implication there is like, oh, okay, well, Newtonian physics worked for the time that it, like, it still works, even though now we know it's not true. Like, we have a quantum perspective of physics now. But that doesn't mean that all of the things that we built from Newtonian physics don't work. Newtonian physics works as an instrument insofar as we aren't doing anything beyond the scope of what that instrument can do. And that idea kind of springboard into like the paintbrush as an instrument, the typewriter as an instrument, and in what ways art is science and science is art becomes less distinguishable when you start rephrasing science as a tool in the same way that all tools kind of, I mean, humans were painting on cave walls for as long as they could build something to paint on cave walls, right? So like this idea of art and the tool have always kind of commingled, even insofar as the tool may have originally been made to serve other purposes, there's always an inspiration in us to lean towards something creative. And so I love that you are bringing that conversation to the table of like how technology, how, and I, you know, it's hard, I don't even know that we need to get into the debate about whether this is copyright, and I do have opinions on that, but I may just save it because I don't actually view what you're doing as even falling in to that potential category because of all of the self-discipline restraints that you put on yourself and the program, like telling it to only pull from medieval archives. But also like once you enter into the realm of collage, like now I'm asking, well, is every collage artist infringement of copyright? Like, and I listen to a lot of electronic music, so that idea of the clipping, like taking clips and stuff from other things, is like very active in that community. So like that idea of the sharing, the co-communal art, that co-creation doesn't bother me from that level. And I don't think we need to ask the question of, are you stealing from modern artists? So why even bring up that political issue, I would say. So I don't know, like, if you want to springboard off of any of that or...
Yeah, well, look, I consider myself very lucky to be in the position that I'm in, because I am not a public astrologer yet. I don't know if that, you know, if that is a possibility in my life or not, but currently, right, I don't have a personality staked in the community, right? I am adjacent, I think, by virtue of the fact that I am personally very interested and involved with these ideas, but I don't have diplomatic relationships, right? To curb around these topics, and so I suppose, yeah, you know, like I get to just, you know, take weird, you know, less mainstream stances maybe on this stuff, and not be as controversial maybe, or, you know, like not getting, you know, other people's spaces that it's, you know, trying, because I understand all of that, right? You know, there are diplomatic structures, right, that need a certain way of going about topics before they go through their full cycle from being like a fringe idea to being mainstream, which is something that happens to a lot of things, right? Just like you said, you know, I mean, you know, all we have to do is look at digital art just as a whole. I mean, you know, I feel like these problematics are just about as old as computers, right? I mean, you know, and anyone that was interested in these tools and spaces at that level, I think have been asking those very questions forever. As far as, you know, like copyright and all of that, again, right, you know, I find that my generation especially, you know, it's just at, I don't know, like I feel like these kind of let's call it like it's like a collective quest, right, that we've been involved in to figure out which ones of these gray areas truly belong to us to express ourselves, right? I mean, we've seen this in so many forms. Oh my God, should I burn CDs? Oh my God, should I sample, you know, to make a electronic music track, just like you said, you know, all of these ideas, I think, are ultimately meant to go clarify something else that I very much hope in my heart have very little to do with the boring dimension of bureaucratic, rule sets that define these things, right? For any individual in society that is interested in moving things forward. And granted, moving things forward is often, if not almost always, a bad idea, right? But, you know, someone's got to do it, right? You know, type of thing. And I haven't really seen personally this happen in a way that is like so disruptive to the community, right? Like an experiment like the one I produced, I don't think is ever going to, you know, affect, say, like an entire economy the way that any of these things have in the past. And they truly did, right? Like there are examples like that can be brought up. And so knowing that there is a spectrum of disruption, right, when introducing these new experimental approaches to things, I feel actually very good about, you know, doing it, and about, I especially feel good about talking to people about it. And I really do consider the book, because again, the project was already meaningful to me. I did not think about it as a book. I think the project wanted to become a book so that it could also be a dialogue, right, to be had with other people without having to explain too much, right? Like, hey, what do you mean? It's like, well, look, there's a book, it's a physical thing, it's made of paper, which is already kind of weird, right, and interesting, you know, all of this cascade of technological ideas and digital, you know, machinations, still is a good old-fashioned book, you know, that you can just have and, you know, do, you know, regular old magic with, right, you know, like take the book, write on it, you know, splatter it with your concoctions, write your own, you know, planetary symbols on it. And I think that the ability that we've retained, right, to like take these things and then incarnate them in physical iterations proves once again, even more so to me, that this stuff is worth pursuing, that this stuff is worth exploring, because if it results in something that is well integrated, you know, in our culture, such as a book, then I really don't see any of the danger or the harm coming in anyone's way. Yeah.
Well, look, I'll say this: the question of the way that technology affects capital is implicitly a capital question, and you know, capital being people's access to power. Personal agency, personal power, whether that be social or material, okay? Mm-hmm. When it comes to technology itself, I love that you use the word spectrum, because you're highlighting the fact that the technology is a tool. And the tool in the hands of different people can be utilized across a spectrum. And that spectrum relates to their access to capital and their personal, like, ethical relation to capital. So here we come with the problem of people being upset about things like mid-journey because they are already struggling to provide for themselves doing the occupation that gives them joy, which should be, I think ought to be people's right to have their occupation be that which gives them joy. So they love to make art. It takes hours and hours and hours to make a lot of this art. And now you have people who haven't put the time in to learn that skill or to put the time in to create it physically, and they are now selling it, making just as much power, both materially and socially, that they were putting hours of physical work into. So that's obviously a salient argument, and people have every right to be mad about that. But the question that I would like to ask is, like, to what extent do you want to get mad about people's joy, or do you want to get mad about your inaccessibility to power, to capital? And so that is a question I don't think we need to ask necessarily on this pod. It's a very I don't have an answer to it. It's very complicated, but, like, we have to give nod to both the fact that if we dream of liberation, then we don't want to constantly make nods to capital and say, yes, you're taking away from their monetary value. We should say, how can we make sure that people don't need to sacrifice their joy for monetary capital? But that's a different question. And, like, what comes up with what you're doing in your book, by the way, of making sure that your use of the tool within capitalism, in which you have to, even though you would like to just create for pure joy, you would just like to create for your pure spirituality, you have to give nod to the fact that there are people who are oppressed who need to not be stolen from. So you have gone through all the channels necessary. Like you said, you, when you were doing it for pure joy, you added in Jay's sigils, but then it became, okay, if you're going to capitalize off of this, you have to remove his sigils. You're only pulling from medieval databases. You're cutting those things out and pasting them on top of each other. So it's already a collage activity. That's like multiple layers of removal from the original author. You know, how, and that's like the question that comes up in the law when we're talking about copyright is, like, how different is it? There's like a certain percentage of similarity that it's allowed to be so that there can be sampling in music, so that we can have collage artists sell their art, right? So these things are all the way that we navigate the fact that we are all oppressed, and we're all oppressed as in we aren't allowed to live for joy, even if that is what we ought to be allowed to do. And I think it's very beautiful that you've not only found a way to showcase, like, hey, this technology, this tool that you're so afraid of, you're so afraid of it stealing your capital, you're so afraid of it stealing your power. There are ways to navigate that spectrum, give nod to the fact that there are people I don't want to steal power from, but still use this tool as an instrument of joy and of creation and of art. So it does open that dialogue. It does create this portal that you're trying to create. That's kind of like an intersection of how do I meet capitalism in the middle? How do I meet the change of technology and the fear and the terror of that wildness in the middle? How do I meet it with joy? And so, yeah, like, that's, I know that that was like a very heady response, but, like, that's my response to everything you're putting down. I was trying to avoid saying all of it, but I was like, whatever, I keep thinking it, so I'm going to have to say it.
Yeah. I think it's important to say it, because it feels, important to you, right? You know what I mean? It, like, you're obviously not an isolated case, right? I think it is, again, it is key to keep confronting, you know, each other on topics like this. But the hope is that we do it on the basis of meaningful projects, right? And things that are as imbued with personal significance as possible, so that we are never just disagreeing on these super high systems that are always going to be above us, even metaphysically, right? You know, like, I don't know, me personally, I just never really like found too constructive, right? Like trying to attack an idea at its highest possible level of abstraction, right? You know, like, it, I think a very good, and maybe this is just because I'm not good enough of a philosopher, right? You know, but like, for me, you know, if I have to sort something out, I would hope that me and the person having the debate are using as much of a personal perspective as possible, so that first of all, we can humanize each other in the process, and second of all, we can restrain our problem solving expectations to something that is specific, you know, at the very least. That said, I will say this, right? I think all of the things you said, which I don't think are heady at all, I think are rather logical, actually, and very, I actually find a lot of this very emotional rather than intellectual, right? You know, there is what I see when listening to people's reactions to this phenomenon, right, is something that's a lot more somatic, right? I think that we as humans have, and thankfully, I think, right, we have a like gut reaction to these new externalized versions of ourselves, because that's ultimately what we're talking about, right? It's the externalized technology versus the internalized technology, or human technology versus artificial technology and all of that. Now, whether or not you wanna contribute to a worldview in which the two are, you know, necessarily coexistent and just two sides of one thing, that's not necessarily what we're concerning ourselves with, as much as I think everyone has a right, you know, to react to this with as much fear or joy as they desire. That said, I think that new languages and new powerful tools always offer two paths. One is going to be characterized by shortening your distance from a goal, and very likely inflected by corruption and deception. And the other is going to be inflected by patience and virtue and seriousness and all of the above, right? You know, we can keep going down the list, but you know, like, those are some, I feel like, salient concepts that usually define, right, like the two possibilities that everyone is confronted with when receiving, right, something that's powerful. I mean, you know, you mentioned capitalism. I think money basically always does that, right? You know, when it comes into anyone's hands. And so, you know, in a sense, I mean, I feel like we're constantly tormented by this kind of forking path, double choice thing. Whenever we receive something that, you know, is either going to empower us to do something that, at least according to our moral compass, right, you know, is as good and steeped in personal principles as possible, or something that is literally the opposite to that. And, you know, I think that there's no shortage of people that, you know, would find, say, like a print in an old vintage store, scratched the signature of the artist, put their own on it, framed it, called it good, and, you know, like, made up a whole business, you know, like, that there was revolving around that. I'm sure someone did that at some point. And so the fact that there are individuals that make that choice should not hinder my desire to stick to higher principles and to contribute to a worldview in which we can all be as virtuous as possible, right? So that said, I'm not implying that my choices are necessarily an example of that, right? You know, like, again, this is like subjective as far as I'm concerned. But I will say this, right? What I really can appreciate about the way this came about is that the work was done because it needed to be done. And then, so because my livelihood is not connected to producing these paintings. And again, I want to call myself lucky, you know, for having had the opportunity to do this the way it happened, because it's not always the case. But for me, this is what happened, right? I did this because it needed to be done, and my livelihood was not connected to it. But Jen's livelihood was, right? Revelor Press is a book publisher, and what they need is people to provide content to be turned into books. And so I cannot think of a better case scenario where the content was already there and someone else invited it in their own framework, right? You know, to create something that they depend on. And if I can help with that, I think, you know, that it at the very least sets out the right principles to then have conflicts, right? You know, because if we're going to have conflicts in a vacuum, it's very, very complicated to resolve them or to keep having constructive dialogue about them, right? I'm not saying that because this was my experience that it presents a case that's conflict-free, but I can at least orient these conflicts around things that I know very well, you know, the coordinates of, if that makes sense, you know. And so that's what I would say in response to that.
Okay, no, lovely. I mean, conflict leads to creation. There's a reason why Mars and sex are related.
fair enough. Yeah.
All right, well, I mean, I think that we've discussed that political side of it, and you brought up a very good way for me to segue into this, that there was the book needed to be made. And that is something I do want to return to. I said I had a lot of things I needed to say in relation to the introduction you gave. And one of those is like, oh my gosh, I remember what it was like being first introduced to astrological magic. And like, so I'm not an astrologer, so we do live in the internet age, and I do believe in the power of technology and community. So I would pay Nina Griffin for her elections. And then I would, so those come with, it's just the election time, stones and herbs that go good with the planet, and like a vague paragraph of what that election might be good for. And the rest of it is just up to you. And so it's like this beautiful, I loved the blank page, but was like also somewhat overwhelmed, like, and also struggling to figure out how to carve something into stone. I remember my first election of realizing I'm missing it. It's not happening because I didn't even have, I was like, can't even get this Dremel to make a straight line in this stupid goddamn stone, let alone in fucking 20 minutes. But so I know, and then what you're talking about did need to be made. And I love that you're even saying like, yeah, Xerox, copy it, print it out, splatter paint on it, burn it at the altar, whatever you need to do. Like, so it does kind of, it's almost making me feel like you're, in a way, it's not a grimoire. It's not a grimoire. It's something, yeah, it's a book of talismans. It's literally a book that you gave. Okay, that's my next question. Did you make all of the talismans during correct times that you thought were auspicious for so you did the planets, the decans, and the fixed stars,
and the mansions of the moon,
and the mansions of the moon. So were did you time the press play on my program for like auspicious elections, or how did that go?
No, yeah. If I had to find an actual election for each of these, some of those talismans are not like we'd have to wait like 20 years, okay, you know, for them to be made, you know, depending on the image. What I did do is at least for the decans, I did a full decan walk. So those, and the mansions too. So like the mansions, I did like just following the moon's ingress in each proper sector. of that particular zodiac, and then same with the decans. The planets, well, the fixed stars don't have as much of a timing thing, except, you know, being, you know, in conjunction with the moon or other planets. And, you know, like, I mean, the stellar astrology, you know, exploration is in itself actually pretty new. You know, I mean, like, there's people still experimenting wildly with what that means. So yeah, I wouldn't have had too many guidelines for that to begin with. And then the planets I just did, you know, yeah, those were the first images I made. And it makes sense to me that it happened like that, right? So I worked on the planets, then I did the stars, then I did the mansions of the moon, and then I did the decans. And I like the way in which, you know, the spirits wanted to be arranged in that regard, you know, and like be brought forth as images. I think it makes sense, you know, like getting this kind of more general, more muddled, you know, meanings from the planets, and then the fixed stars getting a little more specific, and then the mentions of the moon being very mysterious but very, very timed, and then the decans, obviously. I mean, you know, like the decans, that was a whole thing, because I didn't know much about the tradition, which, from what I understand, we haven't found like the perfect agreement, right, on what decanic tradition actually, you know, is supposed to be and how to properly interact with it. But at least from, you know, the teachings of Demetra George, one thing I found out about the decanic, you know, organization of the sky, I thought was very beautiful, is that those were coordinates that were used to properly time people's burial lifespan, basically, right? So like the moment you die, you would record the decanic position of the stars, and then when those would come around at the same position, that would be the full cycle of your embalming period, basically. So that you could, I guess, properly ascend back to the precise point where you were supposed to be housed in the afterlife. Please, you know, listeners, don't quote me academically on this. This is like, you know, my piece back memory from, you know, like her talk, but I'm pretty sure it's pretty accurately what it is from her perspective. And I thought that was very, very beautiful. And again, you know, if nothing else, the technology brought me closer to that idea, right? And, you know, it's like, and the, you know, the experience was just full of those little opportunities for me to learn more, to interact more, to expand my relationship with these ultimately transhuman entities, which is, I would say, in conclusion to this dialogue, right, is really what we're talking about. These artificial intelligences that are running around are not, or let me rephrase this, I don't think it's very constructive to think of these entities as something that is arbitrarily being unleashed on ourselves by some, you know, greater, you know, evil plan or something like that. I think that to take them as an integral part of our human experience and as something of a return to having an opportunity to interact with transhuman entities in our daily life, in our domestic space, which, by the way, was much more common culturally and anthropologically, you know, in other times in history, right? We have experienced this collectively very strongly. And I think I would find very little resistance when I say that we are in fact in a kind of metaphysical renaissance, in a period where many of us are becoming connected to these ideas again and inviting them fully and, you know, in our everyday life. And while, just like we said before, while it is absolutely true that you can utilize and leverage these things for rather disturbing and nefarious purposes, I think that, you know, the opposite is always true. And I think that it is going as far back as you can possibly go with our relationship to, you know, spirit work, right? I mean, one can interact with, say, demons for you know, for reasons that very few people will agree, right, are worth pursuing when it comes to harming each other, right, and provoking very, very deep and very impactful, you know, like negative, you know, events in the world. I'm not gonna choose a camp to determine whether these things are good or evil, because that's completely pointless. But we do know how to at least like draw a line right around the quality of experiences. And I think that there's always a choice. And I think that the possibility is really here and it's knocking at the door. And you know, we'll see what happens.
I'm excited. For you, and I'm glad that you opened this dialogue, and I hope it promotes critical thinking within the community and creative inspiration for those willing to embark on the new frontier and face. Because I do have to say, I got what you were putting down, that I was like concerned about money and capital and people's scarcity, and you brought up that people are also afraid of the other. And they have like a fear of terror at the reflection of the unknown in themselves within this new birth of a non-human entity. Like, am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, kind of, right? I mean, it's like I was just pointing out that when you use money, right, as an analogy for anything, like I would basically like I would use caution, right? Thinking about money as something that it's like intuitive, right? Or something that it's like to be taken for granted as a simple language. I think money is a very complicated language, that it is absolutely human in nature, but that also contains a very profound layer of occult and esoteric qualities that I don't think many of us fully understands, right? And so, you know, granted that that's like, you know, you know, that could be true. I just think of everything as that kind of, you know, malleable, more like phenomenon based, mm-hmm. right? Perception of things where like an entity or a concept does not necessarily have to be this one thing all the time. There are instances in which shifting, right, you know, like our idea of what something is and how it operates in relationship to us could surprise us, and I very much hope, right, that we all strive to open up that opportunity as basically many times as possible.
No, I mean, I love that. I do just want to say though, when I say capital, I mean power, and that can be social or material. So scarcity on all levels, not just money tangible, but like the value of my safety in the midst of scarcity, and capital being like one's ability to navigate that. But I thought it was salient. I still think what you're saying is like you're taking it to the next level and saying, sure, people want to feel safe. They don't want their jobs to be taken away. They want to be able to feed themselves. They want to be able to say, I am an amazing artist. Everyone look at me. You know, that's that social capital. That's that power and networking that comes from people just being like, you fucking rock, you know, because that's capital, right? But you're saying there's another level of fear there, which is like people are afraid of the other. And they don't need to be afraid of this other. They can be curious. They can approach it with curiosity. And even if it is true that somebody else's curiosity may lead to something scary, that doesn't mean that their use of the tool when engaged with their own agency needs to be scary. In fact, it can lead to exciting new opportunities that they may not have previously considered. Am I understanding correctly?
I think that's a fantastic distillation of at least like part of my approach, absolutely.
So what's the other end?
So Yeah, well, I mean, so these are, it's because they're not my ideas, right? You know, like, it's important, right? You know, this is like, because we're both kind of operating on this again, right? Like we're getting a little higher up in the abstraction, and, you know, kind of like departing a little bit from the personal here. And so I just want to point out, like, so these are not my original thoughts, but I very much adopt, you know, these concepts in my everyday life, and I am hoping eventually, right, to distill a personal version of that. But it's something like, I would say, just to add on, you know, that really great synthesis that you just provided, I just like to live according to this model, which is something like, it is always interesting to notice how you know, being scared of something that is greater and more magnificent than ourselves is ultimately fear of, you know, our own potential. Right. Yay! You know, it's, I think this is no longer, right, like a marginal, you know, or like, unpopular perspective on life. Right. I hear this more and more, and I don't think it's like a way of oversimplifying the matter here, but I just want to, I think that's what we're trying to get at together. Yes. Am I right?
No, absolutely. And I will just go out there and say, in as much as I am comfortable with collage art and collage music, I am also comfortable with collage philosophy, because that's all philosophy ever was anyway, if you really think about it.
I love that. That's great.
Well, I love this project. I love getting to know you and your thoughts, and I hope to continue in dialogue with you and friendship. And I'm excited to use the book, and I hope other people buy it and ask themselves some really good critical questions about technology and their agency and art and all of the beautiful things that can be created that are at their fingertips.
I couldn't agree more. I truly, this has been like an absolute delight. And I just want to say, you know, to that, that it is very much my hope that anyone that wants to reach out, you know, like to me personally, you know, with like uncomfortable questions and or with ideas of collaboration, I really do think that one easy way, right, to orient ourselves around these ideas is if you think, right, whoever you are, if you think that there should be more consistent and specific guidelines around the creative process surrounding these concepts, I very much invite anyone, you know, with proposals to gather in real life or digitally, right, and really sort it out by thinking awesome stuff up. So yeah, I just want to put it out there that I'm very, very open to any of that, and that I really hope that the book and your platform fuels some of that as well.
Yay. Well, I can put contact information in the show notes if you want.
Sick. Yeah, that would be awesome.
Wonderful. Yay. Well, this has been great. Until next time.